your job in meeting one is to get to meeting two. Your job in meeting two is to get to meeting three.
In this episode of Investors and Operators, I am talking with Chris Keller, who is the founder and managing partner of Catalyst Partners. We're going to be talking about fund-to-funds, emerging managers, some interesting things that are happening in the market, and we will start with Chris. Can you give us an overview of Catalyst Partners, and then we're going to dive into some fun questions.
Sure. So nice to be with you this morning, Jordan. So Catalyst Partners is a, I guess technically a fund-to-fund, but we have a very specific focus on seeding or anchoring new and emerging private equity funds. So a typical investment from us would be somewhere around 25% of the intended fund size of the underlying fund. We've gone early, first close in every single investment we've made. So the idea is to really plant a stake in the ground for that manager, help them raise enough capital to go really execute a few things, which is be relevant in the deal market and execute a deal or two in the fund with our capital, hopefully even in advance of regular fundraising, so it's no longer a blind pool for other investors, to use the capital and the management fees from that capital to help reinvest in the team and to build out both back office and front office team support. A lot of emerging managers may have the financial wherewithal for the founding partners to maybe go without a salary, but it's really expensive to build a team. And so that's really one of the other things we're helping them solve for. And then the third part is just to have a partner behind you that hopefully, we can help add value along the way. So usually back office infrastructure and compliance related issues are not something the manager has had a lot of experience in their prior roles. So we can certainly lean in there. We've got people who can assist with that. But then on the fundraising side, try to leverage our networks, our LP relationships to help open a few doors, to help really accelerate the fundraising process and be a partner with the manager in that process. So that's what we do. Quickly on organizational kind of background, we are part of Moelis Asset Management, which is an $8 billion asset management platform. We have investments in and interest in a number of alternative asset managers. We've seeded hedge funds, venture capital funds, a CLO business, a direct lending business. And really all that we sort of have a view towards seeding, young GPs and partnering with them to help them build their franchise. We've done that historically off balance sheet or on balance sheet. And when it came to seeding private equity funds at the scale I'm talking about, we really needed to drop it into a fund structure, raise outside money. So it's a common DNA across the platform, a common experience, but just slightly different structure given the size of the checks that we're seeking to commit in private equity. We've been doing this now I've been doing it for almost 7 years. Catalyst is really an outgrowth of a former version of the business that we ran called Archean Capital, which was a JV with a multifamily office. And so we pursued this thesis under that JV structure for 6 or 7 years, and then about a year or so ago, maybe almost a year and a half ago, we decided to pursue the thesis on our own and then rename it Catalyst Partners.
What are some of the under the previous JV for agreement and firm, like what are some of the companies that you back or firms that you backed, and that'll kind of lead up to where we're at today?
Yeah, so we've made 6 investments through the Archean structure. We've now made 1 investment through the Catalyst structure. So we've done 7 overall. Some of the more higher profile names that we backed through the Archean funds included Middleground Capital, which was John Stewart and others that spun out of Monomoy. I think they're raising their 3rd fund now, so they've been quite successful. Some other ones include a group called Petrichor, which spun out of OrbiMed. Several years ago, focused on healthcare investments. We've got another one called Invictus Growth and a few others. So those are the 3 that are kind of the most established that have kind of been in the market or, have raised a second fund or in the process of raising a second fund. So probably have a slightly higher profile than the others.
Yeah. Well, maybe to this, to the first investment out of Catalyst, I don't know if it's public or not, but if it is, we can talk about it. But maybe you could talk about the process. Like, when did you meet the manager and just what was important to you in the different stages and why did that particular manager stand out And what are some of the lessons that other emerging managers can take away from this?
Yeah, so this one's going to sound like a really long process, but I assure you, it's not the probably not the norm. We originally met this manager almost 3 years ago, around 3 years ago, when they were leaving their prior firm. They spun out of Centerbridge, and the one of the Moelis bankers was familiar with the Centerbridge organization, familiar with the people, and had made the introduction to us back then. At the time, the team really hadn't come together. There was you know, there just really wasn't a path to an investment from us. And they went off like a lot of managers do. And they operated as an independent sponsor for several years and did two investments as an independent sponsor. And as they were approaching kind of the LOI stage of what would have been their third investment within their firm, we re-engaged them on a just, you know, sort of the parallel pathing, whether doing that as a third independent sponsor deal or perhaps getting a close done and doing that investment inside the fund and to you know, sort of begin the fundraising process around that. So obviously that's the path that we ultimately went down. In terms of, you know, I guess what we're looking for or what the selection process looks like. I mean, I think we probably, it doesn't sound much different than most any other LP in terms of some of the character traits or just, you know, track record or other things. And I think a lot of people confuse first-time funds with first-time managers. That's obviously not what we do. We're focused on people who have been trained at leading firms, have a legitimate track record. It may or may not have legal attribution to the track record, but there's something there that you can get comfortable with and dig in around that. So that's all, I think, fairly routine or normal relative to most LPs. I think the difference is maybe the speed and the cadence of making that commitment. You know, most LPs, you know, there's not a lot of rewards for going first. There's not a lot of rewards for being in the first close, maybe being the only LP in that first close. So there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg thing that is often a bit of a headwind for some LPs. We know how to navigate that. We're comfortable navigating that. We don't have any rules on being greater than, call it 10% of the fund size, which is another limitation that sometimes LPs are challenged with. So that's something I think that we lean into and try to solve for. I think some of the things that we screen for or think about that might be different than a typical, you know, LP in their consideration process is, as I kind of mentioned earlier, you know, managing the firm and call it the headaches and the just different things that a manager needs to consider in building a firm, they probably haven't done before. So they probably haven't run an institutional back office. They haven't been involved in, you know, compliance related or regulatory issues, but, you know, probably selecting vendors, you know, whether it's fund admin or audit or any of those types of third-party vendors they may not have done before. And probably fundraising is something that's a new skill for them. So, you know, these are things that a typical LP is investing in an established manager probably doesn't spend a lot of time in their diligence process thinking about. But we obviously have to because we're, you know, we're betting on people who are building a new firm. And some of these are big things or skills that I guess you have to build confidence that the manager is capable of doing them, even if there is not an explicit track record of doing them. And so that, you know, you have to lean into, you know, screening for character traits that maybe give you confidence in kind of a growth mindset, somebody who's shown progress in their career and the ability to take on new roles, things that are kind of elite for them professionally and kind of have this, I think of this, call it the slope versus intercept concept, the intercept being kind of where you are in your career at a point in time and the slope of a line being kind of the growth path of that individual. And so that's kind of one thing you have to think about. I think humility is another one, you know, having the self-confidence, you know, this is a very self-confident business and people who show humility to sort of not know the right answer to things or looking for a partner who could help them navigate some of those issues is something else that we score highly for. So anyway, that's a couple of ideas on what kind of differentiates our process from a typical LP process. But I think the nuts and bolts of track record and team and everything else is probably very similar to what other limited partners might consider.
So what are some of the considerations that emerging managers should have and just thinking if they should go down the fund of fund route or not? You know, and I'm making probably some inaccurate assumptions here, but if someone comes out from a good firm where they've been with the team, why do they need a fund to fund? And if they have a very focused strategy, you know, who are the types of teams and emerging managers that truly do need it and actually don't?
Maybe I'll start with the ones that don't, because it's almost more, it's almost a more obvious path for them. So, you know, there are groups out there that leave marquee brand name, very successful investment shops. So they come out with a certain kind of halo pedigree. Those shops, you know, there's different dynamics in the how those departures play out. They can be very acrimonious and contentious, or they can be pretty pretty friendly and amicable. And so the ones that are tend towards the more amicable end tend to come with things like a legal attribution to a track record, you know, the love and support of the prior organization, kind of giving them a helping hand. I've seen groups that even like office with their old firm. They leverage the back office infrastructure and the office space and everything else of their prior firm. They maybe even raise money from the partners of their prior firm. There's just lots of little, you know, nuggets of support and just, you know, kind of lowers that kind of perceived first time fund risk for that first fund. They might even have taken a team with them. So a spin out where it's not just a single manager or a founder, you know, locking arms with someone else they knew, but they're really just lifting out an entire team from the prior organization. If that's done in an amicable way, you know, those fundraisers can be relatively efficient and probably don't need to partner with someone like us. I think we traffic more in, there's just a level, there's going to be some level of complexity probably in everything we do. Not, you know, not hairy, but just it might be a team that is not a full spin out, that maybe does include some new members that have had a shorter operating history together. Or it might be the lack of an attributable track record, or, you know, there might be, you know, some sort of acrimonious relationship with the prior firm. All these things just create some level of uncertainty in terms of other LPs. We don't make those decisions lightly. We do lots of diligence to get comfortable with them. But that's, you know, that's an area where a partner who's kind of traveled that path and done the work can be helpful to the GP, because if they go talk to other limited partners, there's someone who's already done that work. It can kind of create some sort of like path for other LPs to follow in terms of diligence and who you talk to and how you got comfortable with item one, two, or three on the list. And I think that can be pretty helpful to the GP. So those are, I guess that's the difference between why someone would take us or not take us. I think the other, I guess, consideration is, you know, these are high-risk decisions. Someone is left behind, probably a successful organization. Oftentimes, they forfeited economics to do it. They're investing in their own business in some way, shape, or form, whether it's foregone salary or they're actually going out of pocket to fund the working capital for other members of the team. These, you know, this is a high-risk proposition. And the odds of failure are particularly high. And so some stats that I've heard at a conference from another group that does something very similar to ours, and that's a lot of data, you know, they estimate that the failure rate is around 90% in terms of groups that try to launch and raise a first fund and aren't successful in getting to a first close. So that's a pretty high, you know, that's a pretty challenging endeavor for groups. And if someone like us, you know, a seed early anchor LP can help shift the probability of success to something much higher, you know, that obviously goes into the why a manager would consider working with someone like us. And to date, the seven managers we've done, the six that are seasoned enough, they've all been successful in raising outside capital. And so, you know, while if the failure rate is 90%, we're at currently 100% in terms of people being able to get to a first close with third party capital. So, you
that's
know,
really
that
interesting. I had no idea it was that high. And we'll just say directionally, at least it's over 75%. And even if we're being super conservative. And it's just really interesting in understanding the pros and cons. And I think, you know, I was less aware of the upside of working with the Fundify, but it's, you know, it is the complexity of it that needs not the handholding, but just that true partnership of like, here's how you set up the back office. Like, here's how you think about raising the rest of that 75%. You can leverage our relationships. Yeah. And also you're going to be in a portfolio that you're not going to be siloed. You're going to be working with other emerging managers that are part of it.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a best practice to share across the group. That's for sure. You get a little bit of that. And I think we, look, me and my team, we've been buyers. We've been LPs for, you know, close to 20 years. And so we have some sort of pattern recognition and hopefully, some sort of opinion on what works and what doesn't work, and what other LPs are going to be thinking about. And we can, sort of offer that up as maybe some lessons learned over the years that might be useful to groups that we've backed.
What do fund of funds generally ballpark? What are the economics that they ask for?
Well, so if you mean, if fund of funds don't do what we do, we're a seeding strategy. So maybe I'll compare myself to other seeding strategies and what some of the considerations are for folks. So there's groups out there who will take an equity stake in the business, a permanent equity stake in the business. And then there's groups who may lean more heavily into some sort of preferred deal flow around co-investments to try to average down their fees. We don't focus on either one of those. We're our economics are not permanent, and they are top line oriented. So what we're trying to do is not entangle ourselves with how to run the business, making sure that the manager has sort of line of sight to the terminal value of the business, the kind of perpetual value of the business is more for them. So those are kind of two considerations. Is if you're going to sell a piece of your business, you obviously don't, it's not necessarily advantageous to do it on day one when your valuation is probably at its low point. Not to say it's not worth consideration, because it helps you grow the business. It helps you grow the business. But so that's kind of one. And then also governance. We try to not entangle ourselves with how to run the firm. So what the profits of the firm are, how they hire and fire, how they pay. We want to make sure we avoid that. And then on the co-investment side, we think it's important to, what we're trying to do is help them grow their franchise. And oftentimes to grow that franchise, what you want to do is the manager using that co-investment flow to attract other limited partners to the fund. And oftentimes co-investment is an important part of that. So making sure there's enough of these other considerations that you can attract other LPs to the fund, and that's how the franchise grows and becomes successful, and making sure whatever we do doesn't dissuade others from following in our footsteps.
So how'd you get into this? What's your why for doing it?
So I spent over a decade as an investment consultant advising institutional investors, and I think we had a particularly unique culture and structure in terms of how we advise clients. And we had a degree of discretion that was a bit unusual for most consulting firms. And we had a culture that really encouraged us to not follow the herd and to find conviction and ideas that were maybe at the margin made clients even a bit uncomfortable. So, we got very heavily focused on a lot of niche and emerging strategies over the decade there. We ended up sort of accidentally doing over 50 emerging managers from that seat, which is a pretty unique track record for a consultant. And I woke up one day towards the end of that run and had never cut the data, but cut the data, and that the performance was doing quite well, those emerging managers. And more importantly, perhaps, is that I sat back and thought about really what I liked doing and where I wanted to spend my time. And underwriting the next, fund 7, fund 8, fund 9 was just not how I drew energy. I really drew energy from working with the younger firms, feeling some sort of part of their success by being an early partner to them. And yet at the same time, reflecting on where my clients were at, and they still had this kind of artificially higher bar for emerging managers. And I figured that was probably reflective of the overall LP market. So this idea that the capital got treated well, I really enjoyed doing it, I drew energy from it, and there was a market opportunity because of the kind of some of the incentives for most LPs. It felt like a compelling investment thesis as well as a compelling kind of business opportunity. So that's what led me to go pursue this.
So maybe over the past year or so, how many emerging managers do you think you've had at least a first substantive discussion with? And then what can you kind of extract from that on, or kind of guide the audience on, here's how you have a successful phase one of fundraising, maybe even down to the first meeting? Like, let's just break it down to, like, first the data point about how many you had substantive conversations with, and then how do you have a successful phase one, and also how do you have a not successful phase one?
Right. Yeah. So on volume, we've been averaging, somewhere between 250 and 300 kind of first meetings per year, or like inbound, or top of the funnel deal flow. That's a combination of inbound and outbound efforts, but somewhere between 250 and 300 has been the norm. And from that, we seek to make maybe 1 to 2 investments a year. So somewhere in the, kind of 1-ish% kind of pull-through rate. So that's the volume, which also suggests of how many people are out there actually trying to raise first funds. It's a much larger market, I think most people recognize. So that's the
How
volume.
many? How many?
In
Actually,
terms
that's a
of
good question. Like, how many do you think?
yeah.
How many first-time funds buyout strategy do you think are actively in the market right now that are, just generally speaking?
Yeah. So active is a needs a little bit of a qualification, I guess, because some people don't actually launch. They don't actually have formal, legal docs or anything like that. But they're canvassing the market. They're talking to people like us to see if there's an interest in a fund. And that could be people still employed at their current firm. That could be people operating as an independent sponsor, or some variation around that. So there's, in terms of like how many there are, I'm sure we don't have 100% kind of market share or whatever in terms of like at least having conversations. So my guess is it's somewhere north of 300 in the last year, have at least considered it. Somewhere between 300 and 400 would be my best guess. I think the other way to measure it is how many actually get to a first close. And generally speaking, data from PitchBook and Preqin and others suggest somewhere around 40 to 50 a year get funded. So that gives you kind of a sense for the how many of those initial conversations turn into first or final closes.
And that's 40 through 50 of the 300 or 400 for buyout.
Buyout and growth. Yeah, I'm excluding conversations we have with groups that are not in our kind of wheelhouse. We only do buyout and growth related strategies. So venture capital, credit managers, infrastructure, real estate. We sometimes source a few of those because people reach out, but it's not within our investment focus. So
So
I'm
there are
excluding those from the top of the funnel.
so 300 or 400 actively in the market, fund one buyout, and about, call it 50, get to a first close. And overall, do you think it's probably 80% plus are going to have a fail rate?
I think those are directionally correct numbers. Yes, I mean somewhere in that magnitude. A lot of those groups, maybe it's not even a fail fundraise. It's just maybe failed in the sense that they didn't get to a close, but they continue to operate as a firm and they go off and they become independent sponsors and
And then 3 to 5 years
continue to
later, then
execute
they come back
deals.
to the market.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So a lot of the deals that ended up not transacting with us over the last, call it 5 years, those are still conversations that we have. Obviously, the one we just closed on, fit that bill. It wasn't a fit for us, 3 years ago, and in 2023, it was a fit. So, these things do circle back around at
I
times.
think that, that's really interesting of it's a difficult choice to make between when to tank the business and when to persevere. And just generally as
Right.
entrepreneurs, because, as this is our second business, we've had two nonprofits. Our first one didn't work and that dragged on too long. And then it was my wife, now co-CEO, former lawyer, who's like, no, you need to shut down that business. But that zombie firm would have kept on going for maybe another year or two. And it was a tough choice. So I'm wondering, like,
Yeah.
speaking of tough choices, for those managers who are currently in the market and maybe not getting the wins that they should in terms of phase one fundraising, should they just stop raising money and they should just focus on doing deals?
That's an interesting question. I never had anyone ask me that. It's as you were talking, I was reflecting on what's interesting about that question is we're talking about people whose job it is to own a portfolio of assets. And at times, the best decision for that portfolio of assets is to not put good money after bad into to sell a loser, to close down a company, whatever that decision looks like, to focus on the winners or to focus on getting more capital behind the higher outcomes. But that's easy to do as a portfolio manager because you have 11 other shots on goal versus the one maybe you have to shut down. When it's your own firm, all your eggs are in one basket, right? And so that's a very, very much more personal and more challenging decision. And yet, that's exactly what they probably need to be considering. I think I think one thing you're obviously screening for in this end of the business is a high degree of persistence and passion and the intercombination between persistence and passion. And I think you're right. There's elements of persistence. I think Angela Duckworth talks about this, like sometimes quitting is the right path, right? Like, you know, persistence can almost become a hindrance to success if it's not going to lead anywhere. So there's a certain level of persistence. You don't want to, this is not going to be easy and you're looking for people who have the gumption to kind of see it through. I think passion is the unspoken part of this. And like, I can't tell you how many conversations I'll have with managers where it's an investment thesis, but really doesn't feel like they want to talk to someone like us because we lower the risk profile. You know, they don't want to take the leap until someone like us shows up with money to help them kind of alleviate that risk of taking the leap. And I think this is a business where you kind of have to leap before you look. And so that's a passion driven character trait that these people, they want to be their own boss. They have a particular investment thesis that they want to pursue, and they want to pursue it with passion. And the people that surround them, this is another consideration on first funds, is who joined them? Who is willing to take the risk with them, you know, and leave a successful job to come take that entrepreneurial leap? And so the combination of all that, I think, just adds up to some intangible consideration around passion. If it isn't there, I'd say if the passion isn't there, obviously that's the signal that you probably need to go do something else. So I think it's less a thing of persistence and more of a passion project that people should reflect on before making that decision.
So if they're really passionate, don't give up on the fundraise,
I guess. Or make it work. Like, you gotta, I mean, this is, look, it's, I'm in the same boat. Like, it's hard. It's hard to build a new business, and you got to scratch and you got to claw and you got to improvise and you got to get creative. And you got to take a lot of rejection. And so someone who can do that comes up the other side, they're going to be, you know, obviously more successful. So I think the independent sponsor path is a real path. Like, that is a growing market. There are growing sources of capital for that market. And so I don't think raising a fund is the only, it's not the do or die, decision framework. Like, if you have a deal flow, there is money out there for good deals, and you can continue to exist as an independent sponsor forever, or just as a pathway to raising a fund in a few years, which is, you know, similar to the path of the group we just backed. So I don't think it's a binary fund or no fund decision. I think there's other alternatives that groups with, you know, a passion for the business can pursue. And a lot of them are.
So maybe kind of wrapping this up in terms of the, let's kind of summarize like two or three keys of success for a fundraise and two or three key mistakes during a fundraise.
Yeah. So I think one key to success that I've seen probably in every deal that's been successful is this concept of inside out fundraising. So you really need to have a vision for who those core, you know, closest inner network is, and the people that are going to already trust you and be likely to, you know, to say yes relatively early on, and avoid going too far outside that circle early. Cause what you do is then you create this impression that you're fully marketing before you have some of those early validators. And some of those people that are way outside your inner circle, they need the validation of someone who knew you first. So inside out fundraising and being patient around that, like, you know, everyone gets chopping at the bit. I want to go talk to, you know, CalPERS or something. You don't know anyone at CalPERS. So like, let's wait on CalPERS until you have some critical mass or other kind of noteworthy organizations. So anyway, so that's kind of one. I think another is, and this is something I'm honestly still trying to master, and this is actually something you guys are probably, you know, would be a good vendor for folks on, is the art of storytelling. And like, going into that first meeting or, you know, series of early meetings and having a vision for how you tell your story, I think is absolutely critical. And I see so many pitch books that are just dense with data and content and much more focused on what they do as opposed to why they do it. And so in learning how to tell a story, I think is probably not what most of these people studied. Everyone in this business studied economics or finance or some variation on that. And so, you know, having to kind of rejigger your brain and kind of think like a writer. And like, you know, you're writing a book, you have a chapter one, a chapter two, a chapter three. What prompts the reader to want to turn the page when they finish chapter one and start chapter two and two to three, and having a vision for what that looks like, and little tactical decisions might mean, you know, good stories is not what's included, it's what not's included, you know? So you want to keep it tight. You want the story to not be overweighted or overloaded with too much content. And so I think just having someone help you develop that story, develop what that fun one pitch or that meeting one pitch deck looks like versus what a meeting two pitch deck might look like in three and four or whatever, and just think a little bit more like a narrator of a story than a like someone who's going to go and try to regurgitate every fact and figure of every deal they've ever done in that first meeting. Because your job in meeting one is to get to meeting two. Your job in meeting two is to get to meeting three. And it often means you need to either leave some content undiscussed or, you know, be a little bit more conscious of, you know, creating some sort of emotional hook that causes someone to want to stay engaged. Those are how-to buttons.
I love it. All right. Well, we've covered a lot of ground on this. Any parting words of wisdom for people who are in the thick of fundraising?
In the thick of fundraising, I guess I would say back to the passion, like stick with it. If you believe in what you're doing, you know, keep getting creative and figuring out how to knock on those doors and get through those doors. Things will eventually happen. And then I guess it's just, you know, I think fundraising is there's a certain manufacturing process to it, and knowing, you know, kind of having. I'll be honest, I do what I say and not necessarily what I do. It's hard to keep track of the individual conversations you have with LPs and where are the personal, like what they're personally focused on or what's the right next follow-up for that LP. And 4 weeks later, you kind of lose track of that. So really think about, you know, that setting up that CRM system and the note-taking around it to really consistently build knowledge and a relationship with the LP. And treat each conversation, even if it isn't an obvious path to a yes, that these are no for nows, and you don't want to disappear. You want to kind of have a cadence to figure out how to follow up with those individuals and continue to build a relationship. And so, I don't know if that's words of wisdom or just
that
a shoulder to cry on or whatever, but it's hard.
All of the above.
Yeah. All of the above.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Thanks so much for taking the time to do that. This is awesome. I appreciate it.
All right. Enjoyed it.